Carey from the Oregon Cultural Trust, Oregon's unique engine for funding culture, including KBOO Radio. Oregonians can double the love for culture by making a donation to the Cultural Trust before December 31st that matches the donation they made to KBOO or one of more than 1,400 arts, heritage, or humanities organizations across the state. At tax time, the donation to the Cultural Trust is refunded via Oregon's Cultural Tax Credit. Donors double their impact at no cost to them, and culture across the state wins big. Visit culturaltrust.org to learn more.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:03 and somewhat past time for Pacific Underground, so let's just get right to it.
Hey everybody, happy end of 2017 in December. You're listening to Pacific Underground, the show created by and mostly for hyphen Americans and Asian Pacific Islanders. Today we're bringing you an end of year conversation where we'll look back 12 months and share the reflections and thoughts we never got to share with you. The six of us that are now in Pacific Underground, Jake, Kat, V, Jenna, Tabitha, and me, Kanan, got together earlier this month, and we each chose a clip from our favorite episodes that we aired for you in 2017. And we'll be taking a walk down memory lane with you in a sec. Before we do that, we want to thank all of you who tuned in and supported us this year. It definitely wasn't the easiest of years in recent memory. And maybe that's actually a good place to start. So yeah, I'm going to get out of the way and cut to a conversation we had about something we were up to behind the scenes.
An all-time high.
All in one room.
Wow.
Doing the shimmy shake over here.
If you were to have asked me a year ago if I thought this was possible, I'd probably have my doubts. I think I was in, it was a dark period. There was very few of us making a lot happen.
That's so true.
Look,
that's
how far
so
true. We've come.
I'm really proud of us, you guys.
I'm so happy that we have grown and it feels like an actual collective other than three chickens running around with their heads cut off. What are we doing this week?
let's give our listeners a little info about what they're listening to right now. So we've decided that we're going to have like a little look back on Pacific Underground over the last year. Where did we start 2017? Where are we ending it now? Maybe we'll even be so bold as to say what we're going to be doing next in the 2018. Dun, dun, dun.
I mean, no promises. we can maybe give like the babiest of
bare
teasers.
Outline.
Yeah.
I feel 2017 is also a really good year to look back because it's the first year of Mr. Trump's presidency.
Oh, you said
and
his name.
We're living in a very different America now. And
AKA a dumpster fire.
You can't see this, but V just punched the microphone after you said Donald Trump.
I was taking it out.
That's
my anger.
That's what that was. We've lost the yellow mic.
Okay, so if we started back at like 2017, if we go back to January of 2017.
It was a more innocent time.
A more innocent. Well, it was the time when we were all freaking out because we had elected him, but he wasn't in office yet. And Pacific Underground, we were all freaking out, one, because we were having to deal with the impending apocalypse that was coming. Plus, we were in a moment of mini crisis as a show. We hope that didn't come across on the air. We hope we managed it really well. And you're like, oh, we did. We have no idea. Because we were, as Tavis was saying, that we were running around with our heads cut off, like jigging, you know. Because at the time, in January 2017, Pacific Underground was just three people. It was Kanan and Tabitha and me, Jenna, and it was the three of us trying massively to just get shows out. And then on top of that, we were offered, we went from being a monthly, once a month show to being a twice a month show. So we took on twice as much work, but we had like half as many people as we had had in 2016, and we decided that was a good idea.
What were we thinking?
They were like, well,
it was hard to turn down that opportunity.
I know, and like, I'm really grateful, like, towards Derek, our news director, our AM news director.
Thank you, Derek.
Because like, how that worked was, the show had gone off the air, and he just like approached me one day and was like, "Hey, there's a show that's going off the air, but you know, Pacific Underground, everyone really loves what you guys are doing. So would you like to have a second hour?" And we had kind of toyed with that in 2016, the idea, and we had always decided, like, no, we don't have that capacity. But then when it was put on our plate, and it was like, you either take it or you don't, and here at KABU, we know that, like, getting an hour of programming is gold. That's really difficult to get. So when it was offered to us, it was just like, ah, do you say no? Okay, we'll do it.
One doesn't simply say no to an extra hour.
Yeah, I would really love it if our collective grew so much that we could split off into subgroups, and one group produces the first Friday show, and the other group could produce the fourth Friday show.
Whoa, you said it.
Whoa. Okay, we'll put you in charge of
goals.
That.
Goals.
Go ahead. So then I feel like maybe like Kanan, Tabitha, you can tell me if you think I'm right on this one. But I feel like because we took on all that work, it really forced us to be like, okay, we have to grow this collective, because we were so worn out. Because basically it was like me and Kanan each taking on one show by ourselves, and then Tabitha trying to help us do all the other things that go into like not just producing, but like getting stuff on the internet and finding guests and all this stuff. It was like, it was the most stressful time. Mm-hmm. So we opened up a general membership meeting. I remember that.
And we diverted ourselves away from making the show to recruit people. That I don't know if people actually care about this, but it was a big deal to us because we were like, what are we doing? We're going to allow ourselves to do one rerun. And then while we're doing that rerun, we're going to gather our strength and try to recruit people, which was like not even that successful.
We got V out of it,
and
right?
Elena.
But
Elena.
We already had V.
When was this?
This was like in March, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
I started in January.
April. Oh,
or February.
Yeah, you were already invited, but you decided to go to that meeting, and I'm glad that you did. Because that was like the official.
Okay, so then, so I guess we had Elena that came out of that meeting. But more than anything, I think it just like, it said to us that we were dedicated to just growing our collective rather than just massively panicking month to month to month, and that like we were dedicated to like, make this more organized. And then that's when we started to go more towards the format of having one show month that was pre-recorded and was kind of like our glossy style that we had originally with Pacific Underground. And then like one of the episodes per month was like a live interview, just to like give us some time to not have to make super shiny, super polished, beautiful sounding audio. But it also allowed us to do roundtables and to like come together as a collective and have to do the panic of live radio. I enjoyed it.
Well, I am curious to hear from V, Kat, and Jake in listening to our past episodes. Could you hear the seams coming apart at the start of the year?
No, y'all were pretty put together, at least on air.
Yes.
No, I was not aware.
Mission accomplished.
If you turn the volume real loud, you can just hear the seams busting apart. At the end of every episode, we lost a couple hundred seams.
Now, I feel like we came out of that phase a lot stronger as a collective. It really, honestly, like, it tested ourselves in, like, kind of professionalism. It tested our friendships together. There were definitely times where it was just like, okay, we all just want to quit. But I feel like we also like helped keep each other really motivated, and we kind of came through like stronger. And with a lot, like it forced us also to sort of just have to like let go of having this idea that we could control everything. And we were just sort of like, oh my God, the guests just canceled out. Let's just do whatever. And like it really allowed for innovation. So I appreciate the face. Thanks, you guys. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for
thank you.
Thanks for joining me, people.
Thanks for accepting us into the collective so seamlessly.
One of us. Okay, but we all pick clips from shows from the last year. And Kanan, what did you pick?
I picked an episode that, I guess, the episode where I interviewed Deepei Wu, the labor organizer.
Oh, that one's a good activist. One.
And yeah, I can play that clip. We pretty much just introduced like the whole clip thing, right? Did we lay out that like we have like five six clips? Mm-hmm. Did you choose one, Jenna?
Yeah, I chose one.
Okay, cool. So we have like a 6-course meal coming at us. So I hope you brought your appetites for
never so mind. Play and then we'll discuss and we'll talk about our feels about the clip. Is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we'll just kind of like do
any
hot takes.
Any regrets, comments, you know, questions?
Yeah, I'm not gonna do any like context setting for this clip. I'm just gonna play it, and then we can just jump right into it because I don't want to spend much more breath like introducing this.
Yeah, throw it on.
So here it is.
There's some people in my life right now that are queer people of color that are having a really hard time entering into getting, you know, back into like the labor force, mm-hmm. Whether that's like actual like physical labor or just, you know, getting any sort of job because it is so hard. Everyone is feeling particularly raw, it seems, right now. And a place like Portland is so laden with tension. You know, I think some people are like scared to even go out and just be out in the world because of trauma they've experienced, and they don't want to be encountering people who are going to be triggering them, you know, like mm-hmm. even if they're just on the street, even if they're just trying to like run errands and stuff.
Yeah.
What would you say to people that are like struggling with that right now? I know it's not an easy question and it's very like case by case when you get down to it, but
it's hard. I mean, that's real, you know? So there's that. I think so. That's the most important thing to say, right? Is like that kind of level of everyday harshness and rudeness and everything else is right there. It's right on the surface here in Portland in ways that I would say in the state of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest, you know, mm-hmm. that in some other places in the world is just not quite the same, right? There's also a thing that happens to us internally when in other parts of the country where there's more folks, right? We're not such an anomaly that like at least you can get some basic, you know, normal day-to-day human interaction mm-hmm. When you're out and about in the world. And it's kind of a relief, right? I can feel my skin relax when I go to places like Oakland or LA or even Arizona, right? Like Phoenix, I was in Phoenix recently. And it's like, you can just feel your skin relax because people, they just see you as a human being, and there might be all kinds of other layers of things that are happening around gender and race and things like that. But there's also like you're not the first one of this kind of person that I've ever seen, right? So, there's a reality that to that kind of experience here in Oregon, and here in Portland. You know, the survival skills that I've seen all of us use here. I go out in public a lot less. I usually have at least one other person with me if I can. Like I go to, I have my spots, right? I have my store, I have my one bar. It's not even perfect, but I like to go there because they kind of know me, right? Like I kind of know that even if they're weird, I'm going to get decent service, right? Like,
right.
Or stairs.
So that was a weird.
Yeah, I won't get any stairs
because it was just like, me in the room
at that
with
point, like everybody's got
and
tattoos,
I
whatever.
Don't feel like I really got a chance to debrief from that episode with all y'all. So I have no idea like what you thought of that episode. We haven't really talked about it. Somehow we managed to like not get together and talk about it, but I know that most of you or all of you have listened to it. So I thought that maybe we could kind of just share some impressions on that that conversation of like it being very challenging to just like that much more challenging to go about our lives in the world and just try to be and do things in spite of like a lot of anxiety, a lot of like fear around just being a person of color and just seeing a lot of suffering in other people who do have to put up with more very real traumas and experiences of like just being erased or oppressed.
Well, I really liked this episode in general. Since we haven't debriefed, we'll do a little production meeting right here on air. Mm-hmm. You guys can hear how it goes. It goes, Kenny, that was really awesome. Thanks for doing that interview. Wow, how did you get that? because I really liked how, you know, when we first talked about interviewing Deepay Wu, we always, you know, kind of define people by like their occupations. We're like, okay, let's talk to this activist and they're going to talk about blah. And Deepay was really interesting in that they talked about like their personal side, like what in their personal lives motivated them to do the work that they were doing. And I thought you did a really great job at balancing talking about their activism and then talking about who they were like as a person, because oftentimes activists can get a little preachy, but Deepay is really good at not doing that. And I think that's why they're effective as an activist. They always bring in the like, hey, you guys, remember people's humanity? Like, as we're talking about civil rights, we're really talking about people's humanity. And so I like that you like took that time to be candid with them. And like, it sounded really relaxed, that interview, like, especially by the end, like you heard them getting like more relaxed. And so it was, so yeah. Aside from your question, there's my debrief.
Oh.
Good interview, Kana. Thanks,
Shannon.
Here's a pat on the back.
I unfortunately don't have much to say because I've only heard clips of the interview. I really appreciate what they had to say and their tips on how to survive, yeah, as a person of color in Portland. And having your regulars, knowing people that you trust, hanging out with them.
Wait, do you have regulars? Like, do you have like certain places you limit yourself to because they feel safe here in Portland?
Nongs? Well, not really, because I kind of don't really worry myself with what people really think of me. And when I'm walking around, I just kind of keep my eyes straight. I don't really look at other people, and sometimes I'll notice people doing a double take on me, but I just kind of ignore it. I think I'm really good at blocking out things and just keeping my mind on my task, just worrying about myself.
Yeah, I'm wondering if the idea of just like survival has been on y'all's minds more, and I'm not going to presume that like this past year has been like the same amount of difficult or weird or whatever in the room across all of our experiences. But yeah, if anyone else has anything else to say, I'm really interested. And if not, I think we can just move on to the next clip, because that clip also kind of just like speaks on its own. Yeah. It's just like,
well, I just gonna say real quick, like this moment with Tabitha, what she just said is like so Pacific Underground to me. Where Tabitha, I feel like a lot of the times your perspective is very different from mine. And I always wonder if it's because you grew up here in Oregon and you're really used to growing up in this very white dominated place, because I really identified with what Deepay had to say. You know, I grew up in Southern California where, yeah, I was a minority, but there was a lot of people in the minority, you know. So whenever, like, even though I don't personally like Southern California, I would never go live there again, every time I do go to like visit my parents, I have that feeling of like I get to relax and
it's
feel like
regenerative.
Yeah, it is. It is, just
that
because
part resonated with me too.
Yeah, because no one's looking at me, and like I can go to the grocery store and like here I am, like Deepay, where I have specific places that maybe that I don't go, but there are specific places I avoid and where, because I just feel so uncomfortable because I know I'll be looked at. And so I'm always amazed, Tabitha, that you're able to like move through this space. And I think it's because like that's what you've had to do. I think that's like survival from the time you're like little. You're just like taught like keep your head down. People are going to look mm-hmm. at you. you can't escape it here in Oregon, like you can like in a lot of bigger cities, you know. So I just find that fascinating, where I'm just like, how do you do that, Tabitha? I wish I could do that. I can't.
Yeah, I would definitely agree that it's a product of growing up here and just being surrounded by white people. And I think I've said before on the show, when I am in areas where, such as LA, when there are more POC people, I feel strangely out of place.
What? That's so strange.
I know. I know.
You're like, man, I need all those cars with the Confederate flags on them. So there you go.
I miss being stared at. No, I
know. It's just like, there you go, Pacific Underground, bringing you all sorts of different perspectives.
Yeah, you've adopted to like a very like different, very white dominated and potentially hostile environment, which is...
I am definitely... I would definitely say my mindset is very white-oriented. And Jenna, you once said to me that I talk like a white person. I will definitely agree with that.
What does that even mean? Let's break that down real quick.
Yeah, Jenna, what do you mean by that?
Is that spotlight kind of blinding right now?
We can break that down in future episodes. Because I could literally talk about this forever, about sounding white and code switching and what that's about. Because I'm pretty sure all of us do it. All of us do it, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, I call it my white sounding voice. You have all heard
it
before.
Let's hear it.
What? I've done this on the air before, where it's like inviting Deborah over for tea. Yeah, where it's just like, okay, hold on, I gotta get like in the mindset. I'm wondering if this will make the episode. I hope not. Okay, hold on. Oh my gosh, Deborah, we should totally go out and go get some fresh, I don't know, avocado toast and cucumber water. Cucumber water.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
It's like the falsetto really locks it in.
Oh, yeah, know? Yeah, yeah. Because you got to get like super excited. Like, and maybe you can even do like jumping
emotions clap with this person, you know?
Yeah. That's my imitation of like what I think is like basic white lady in her 40s. Yeah, I have different voices for like all sorts of different ages. Like, there we go. Here we get the calls of hate.
But I definitely agree with what she was saying, that like, I've adapted like, kind of, I haven't lived my whole life in white-dominated spaces like Portland or Idaho or whatever, but enough of it that, like, it is nice to sort of, like, go to a minority-majority place kind of relax my own skin, like she was talking about, you know, kind of feel human again.
So. Yeah, that definitely resonated with me, too. When she brought up Oakland, I just thought of last Christmas when I went home and I visited my brother in Queens, and it was just like, just like standing on the street feeling like so normal. It's so strange.
Okay, whose clip is next?
Who's up?
We could just go clockwise around the table.
All right.
I want to save mine for last.
Okay. Fine.
Mine's like it's like a happy go lucky fun self-care one. So
I have to say that I didn't actually listen to the whole
Oh my god. Someone didn't do their homework.
It doesn't matter.
It's one of the rules of the collective. You're kicked out. To listen to each other.
Is that real?
I never follow that
real
rule, though.
That's not real.
They just made that up.
I'm also the baby member of the collective. I'm very new. So when this episode aired, I was not here in Portland. So I picked the interview. I think it was you, Kanan, who interviewed Hari Kunzru. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Mm-hmm. And it was about his book called White Tears, which I also have not read.
The title is good enough to enjoy on its own.
It's a great title.
Yeah, it was a good discussion.
But anyway, shall we listen to it first?
Or? Hit it.
I'll cut to it. As someone who is not white, how did you go about getting into the psyche of a kind of fragile white college boy hipster?
I'm very familiar with it. And, you know, and also I'd say that while, you know, while I'm not white, I'm also not black as well. And I've, you know, the my initial relationship to black culture and black American culture in particular was through music. I grew up in a very white suburb of London, and it's quite strange that it was a very racist place back in the 80s. It was, you know, there was a lot of the far right skinhead groups around and so on, but there was also a real tradition of caring about soul music, and so all the records that I was hearing and the records that I was buying as quite a young kid, like 11, 12 year old kid, were soul records and jazz funk records and early hip hop records, and this was all going on, and the people who were listening to this music and enjoying it were at the same time expressing incredibly racist opinions about black and Asian people. And this is a kind of paradox of my teenage life. You know, I was very unhappy there, and couldn't wait to leave. And the way I did leave was to go to university, to go to Oxford University, where I fell amongst a bunch of very sort of elite young white men who had a big reggae listening habit, with all the kind of complexities that involves. You know, these sort of public school, you know, private school. I suppose he's a private school. Boys with blonde dreadlocks and red, gold, and green clothing.
Classic.
You know, so that was, you know, something completely different. And, you know, since I was highly exoticized as an Asian for being, you know, although I was actually a sort of suburban boy, you know, so, you know, so I had to come to terms with what it meant, you know, to be so sort of, and I was sort of in love with this. A lot of this music has been part of my life all my life, and yet I was going through a milieu where the people who made the music were not present. They were, in fact, they were, you know, almost excluded from these places. I mean, there were very, very few black students at Oxford when I was there, and so, you know, a lot of this kind of world that Seth and Carter come from in the book is drawn very closely to my experience, and is their kind of, I call it at one point, it's a professorial knowledge of the music is kind of overcompensating for the fact that they know that they don't have an organic connection to it.
Right.
You know, and also I'm interested in the fact that that if you want to say something is great art, and I think a lot of this music is extraordinary, and the blues, you could make a case that the blues is one of the great American artistic achievements. And great art has to be able to speak outside its original context. And even, you know, if you want to say that the African and American originators of blues or jazz have some sort of priority, their work has to also be able to speak to people who aren't black. And what does that mean? You know, what does it mean when you love something but you don't own it? And that's an interesting question to me, because it's a question I had to face with my own relationship with all this music. And, you know, it's something that has to be recognized, that, you know, it is okay to love it, but, you know, it's not okay to try and control it, or, you know, less still to profit from it.
I chose that clip. I think it was interesting to me for two sort of main reasons. The first one, I wouldn't really say superficial, but or I don't think superficial is the right word. But I think as someone who is not American and who didn't grow up in America, I'm always interested in hearing about or sort of considering how non-Americans face or talk about or sort of consider blackness or anti-blackness. I mean, obviously, slavery, oppression, colorism, anti-blackness, that's global, but how are we having different conversations outside of the U.S.? How do we even come to that? You know what I mean? So there was that. And I think one thing that he doesn't mention explicitly, but I guess he was alluding to, was the ways in which, you know, non-black POC could be complicit in things like appropriation or basically just oppression. Mm-hmm. That's a conversation that, you know, I've only, I think, recently just started to learn the vocabulary, that sort of thing. I'm still learning how to, like, have a conversation about it. Yeah, it's important, and I think that's what we're constantly, you know, trying to do or trying to discuss within the collective. And I believe that's an important thing. Obviously, another important thing would be to actively, you know, like, to take action and, like, actively try to dismantle oppression. But I just chose that because I felt like it was it encompassed some of the work that we're trying to do in this collective, I think.
It was like, that was like a deeply personal conversation for me, just because if you're like consuming popular culture in the United States right now, or like have ever, you've been consuming culture that hasn't in its like authentic roots originated with you if you're not Black. Right. And so, like, grappling with that in this narrative of this book, which is essentially like two white boys in on the East Coast going to college, creating a fraud out of a blues musician that may or may not have existed in the first place. It's something I think that each of us individually has to work through. And that's kind of like a powerful way to access people in writing. It's like, yeah, we all have to do that internal work in order to like figure out how to justify to ourselves being like just one participant in the system of like trading, like literal trading of like Black culture in our economy. It's a mind bending thing to have to deal with.
Something I hope we tackle again in 2018. Like, I don't think we really delved into it in 2017. We did talk about it in like 2016 a little bit, but I feel like I'm really surprised actually that we didn't delve more into it in 2017 when so many of those like conversations have been happening, you know, around like, when was that? Maybe when was that letter written? That like group sourced letter that was like Asians
was prior,
right?
It was prior to the election,
I feel like that was like 2016, yeah, mm-hmm. Right?
Oh, the Asian,
yeah, yeah. And we did like talk about it a little bit there, and I feel like we did
like
talk
dear
about
dear uncles and aunties, yeah, kind of thing. Yeah. Here's the deal,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But definitely, it's like a topic that is so,
fraught,
and we could like probably have like a whole show about it. But it's also something that I think in production meetings we've struggled sometimes to understand how to talk about certain topics, because we don't want to just be a bunch of Asians who are just like patting ourselves on the back or like removing, you know, Black people from the conversation. But at the same time, we see that it's really important that Asians talk directly to one another in order to like open up and break down that conversation. So it's definitely something where I'm like, okay, well, now we got six people. Yeah. We aren't in our three-person panic anymore. And like maybe we have more like headspace to make room to have like a much more complex discussion around it, because we definitely talk about it off air. And maybe we should bring that conversation on air more.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely something that like we could explore more because of sort of like where we're located in proximity to whiteness, although there are a lot of Black Asians too, mm-hmm. who kind of in the whole biracial debate or whatever, and mixedness kind of get erased there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I going back to what I said about how I'm more comfortable being around white people, I would definitely say that comfort comes from my upbringing and my family's complicitness in anti-Blackness and just anti-brown people. And it's something that I do try to work on. And definitely when I was younger, my guards would be up if I did see a Black person. And I think having these conversations about how have you been complicit in oppression and racism are really important. and then you can be, because you can't be aware of a problem. You can't fix a problem unless you're aware of it. And knowing that about myself has definitely helped me to re-examine my notions and ideas of race and history and culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really feeling the fraughtness of this conversation right now, because I feel tempted to like just keep diving into deeper into like you have to be, I'm gonna stop myself after I say this one piece, but you have to be ready to deal with like personal shame around your own like anti-blackness, around your own racism and colorism that you've adopted and like projected out there onto the world, and the harm that that's done. And yeah, it's a very emotional experience. And I think that there's a lot of people like in our communities, mm-hmm. in our like racial communities that haven't embraced doing that work yet. And that's hard. And that's probably our work. And hopefully we can continue having conversations that inspire that work and just keep that conversation going. Jake, you wanna take it?
Do we still have our caller on the line there, Sean?
Hi.
Hey, Sean.
Hi. You might not agree with this, but whenever I hear identity politics, I just immediately think of the counterintelligence programs of the 60s and 70s, the dirty tricks pulled by the FBI and COINTELPRO. So I just immediately assume that it's not incompetence at work, it's treachery. Because people just have to be too stupid to get away from identity politics and move to class. It's so obvious that they're changing the subject from economic exploitation and class division to identity politics. It must be treachery. People can't be that stupid. Thanks.
Thanks, Sean. Any response to that?
Well, you know, I certainly disagree with the idea that identity politics is just a distraction, right? We all live in identities, right? We all have identities. All politics is identity politics, right? White people, for example, have identities, and they are manifested within our politics. And, you know, the way in which white identity politics has worked historically has, you know, caused the suppression of people of color and other groups. You know, I think that we think of identity politics in this really kind of trivialized way as, you hurt my feelings and therefore I'm going to fight you. Right. The reality is that, you know, on the basis of identity, people have been enslaved. Genocides have been committed, right? Racial cleansing campaigns, regimes have been put in place. All of these things are justified on the basis of identity, on the basis of the superior, presumed superior identity. So, you know, identity politics activists basically were being beat up and decided to fight back. The left was rejecting us in that period of time when we started to fight back. And so we had no place else to go but to build our own movements. And so the politics of those movements may not reflect some of the understandings of our, you know, kind of economic reality of the left. But I think to put that at the feet of people who are identity activists is ahistorical. It's just like straight out not an understanding of historically how these movements developed.
Well, and then something that, you know, kind of connecting back to what you were saying is that, you know, that identity politics, you know, by engaging in that, we're actually not so much personalizing it. That's what certain people like to look at it as. But it's actually about taking away from the personal and addressing the structural.
Yes.
And so, I find that interesting connection there.
Well, and speaking to the structural, sorry, Tim, but I will be done shortly. You know, I think we need to recognize that, you know, there's this kind of theory, right, that the primary sort of relationship that we need to be concerned about is between workers and capital, right? So class, therefore, is the primary concern of the left, class in economic terms. But that's just a theory, right? We have to put reality first. In reality, capitalism manifests itself in different places in many different ways. In the United States, it manifests itself in the system of white supremacy, right? That system, thinking historically, has a legacy in the form of structural racism and in a culture of racism that we live in, right? So actually addressing that problem is critically important. Movements against capitalism that are not pro-democratic, that are not pro-democracy movements, are dangerous. We only need to look at Mao and Stalin and, you know, we could go on, right?
Yep.
To see why that is really, really important to us. So in order to actually be a pro-democracy movement in the context of a racial state like the United States, we need to actually be able to deal with the issue of race as a significant problem and as completely intertwined with class. In fact, what class in the United States is in part made of.
Wait, so I don't think we introduced your clip, right? So that was Scott.
Oh, yeah.
That was activist Scott Nakagawa, and he was
from the same episode that Kat got her clip from, but a different. That was a roundtable, you know, bookending. That was a roundtable bookending the one-on-one interview that Kanan did with Hari. And I really liked what Scott said to sort of like bring it back to talk about how it's not, you know, like a class issue separate from the racial issue. It's like classes are racialized. So mm-hmm. when we talk about the white working class or whatever, that's an identity politics group too. And yeah.
Kanan, where are you going, buddy? Let's have you say just something like really quick, like, or I don't know. We should be like,
oh, yeah. What do you think?
I think there's like this general dismissiveness around like racial identity and identity politics that I hear a lot from like white friends, like even like very progressive minded ones. I know that's like a pretty like solid word, progressive, but
I mean you hear it from PLC too.
Yeah and it's hard to hear that because it is so dismissive and it seems like such like a hive mind type of judgment passed on that type of like thinking, that it is like very violent. It can be very violent because it can be like, actually your experience doesn't matter and it's not politicized, or you're not able to politicize it in this conversation. And it's like a middle finger essentially when I hear people like just toss out identity politics. I hear people saying like, I don't have time for your identity. So yeah, that's my little quip. And I'm also leaving because I'm a irresponsible person.
Okay, bye, Kanan.
All right, thanks, Kanan.
See you guys.
So why don't we move on to our next clip?
Yeah.
So Tabitha, what was your clip?
My clip is from the March Women's Day episode. If some of our regular listeners will remember, KBOO dedicated a whole day to women's radio, and we just had women's volunteers at the station. Women produced shows and voices for 24 hours, and Jenna and I produced a special show, and that march was rough on the collective because as we were talking earlier about the three of us, that was still just the three of us, and Jenna and I managed to pull off an extra third hour for that month for the special Women's Day episode, and we talked with New York comedian duo SJ and Ginny, who produced this really cute and funny and heartbreaking YouTube series called Quiet Tiny Asian.
Yeah, so I was wondering, like, who is this video series for in your mind? Like, is it for non-Asian people to understand the Asian experience, or is it for Asian Americans to have something to relate to?
It's a little bit of both. I would say it's probably more of the latter. It's more of that I want Asian Americans to see and feel represented in the comedy and the videos and the media that they see. And so there's just like so much validation in seeing like these very like nuanced and like subtle situations happening to you, and you're expected to kind of ignore them or, you know, let it go because it wouldn't be worth it. Seeing that and being validated kind of materializes it in your brain as real, like your racism is real. And I feel like for so many years, personally, I felt that my racism wasn't real because it was so fleeting and so many people did not understand it. So that kind of like leads me to, yes, I would like for non-Asians to also see it, to see the frequency with which this happens, like how ridiculous it can be.
Okay, I totally forgot that we interviewed them. Like, we've interviewed so many people this year, and that was one of my absolute favorites, was finding the quiet, tiny Asian. That was so good.
Yeah. The thing that I really appreciate about it is, in watching the series, oh, it resonated so much about the times when I would make a complaint, especially about my hair, and then people would compliment, oh, your hair is so pretty, though. And it's like, well, thank you, but your compliment is kind of like a backhanded compliment, and I definitely feel like Asian women particularly have this pressure that they're just perfect and beautiful, we're willowy, and it's this weird, even positive stereotypes are still grossly...
But you're so good at math.
They're still just grossly generalizations.
You're so young looking, Tabitha. Asians are so young looking.
I know.
And you have that super thick, straight, shiny hair. Oh my gosh, and you're all Asians, you're so petite and cute.
Oh my gosh, stop talking.
I know. And then what about those poor Asian women that don't fit this, you're willowy or you don't have perfect hair, and that whole Asian women were just beautiful, and fetishizing, and...
Oh, wait, okay. I just have this memory of one of my favorite episodes on the Quiny Tiny Asian, was the, when you're an Asian, you are always together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's about how whenever you're Asian, if there's another Asian in the room, you are always assumed to be with that person. And so it's just like her like being in line, and then like an Asian guy is like behind her, and they're like, okay, party at two. And that happens to me all the time, where people always mm-hmm. assume that the Asian person, okay, I'm going to say this, I'm going to call out somebody in K-pop, I'm not going to say their name. Not gonna say her name. But somebody here at the station was like, oh, I saw you on a flight and you were with your dad. And I was like, what? Like, I have not flown with my dad in forever. And it was because I just happened to be sat. And I have to admit, this flight was weird. I called it the Asian row. For some reason, like, all the Asians on the flight were in the same row. And I was like, what is this? Why am I here? And like, somebody from the radio station saw me on that, was like, oh, that's your dad. It's just like, that's because all Asians are always together. We're always together.
Or if I meet someone, I remember having a job interview at a store. Not going to say what store, but I've only ever been in the store one other time. That was like a year ago. And the interviewee was saying, oh, I think I saw you in here last week. You look really familiar. I didn't want to say anything because this is an interview. This could be my potential boss. But I was not in here. And I was just rolling my eyes. Oh my God, Asians do not all look alike.
Yeah, I feel like the all Asians together is just a close sort of like cousin to the all mm-hmm. Asians look the same, or like calling you by the only other Asian's name kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, grateful for SJ and Jenny for putting that one out there.
Yeah,
that was they're just brilliant.
They make cool videos.
They do make cool videos.
And,
check them out.
And I would really like to... the voices that we all heard were from cis women. I would really like to hear some voices from trans women.
Yeah, we kind of failed on that last year, we'll say. Like, in our follow-up and our post-rush, we were like, oh, man, that was... We did not include all women in this conversation. We basically included our last-minute panic and didn't put enough time into that. That's, like, my criticism about, like, a lot of our episodes this year. It was like, we just didn't have enough time to put more thought into that.
Yeah.
Okay, but talking about time... We need to move on to our next clip. Okay, so...
What do you got, Jenna?
I need to set this one up a little bit. So my clip comes from the show where we interviewed the artist Alex Chu, who has done some murals around town here, and we interviewed him about a mural that he had been painting at the Mac Stop, and it featured his daughter, Mazzie. And it just really, like, the mural is about presenting the different, like, diverse communities in East Portland. But that's not why I like the clip. I chose the clip because it is like why I love doing radio. Mazzie, the two-year-old, like, I think she was like 2.5 at the time, she came in for the interview because Alex watches her during the day, and you can hear her. So when you, when you're about to hear the clip, you can hear her talk a little bit. Like, she's whispering a little bit, and she's asking him if he can leave because she's really, like, over being on the air. And you can hear a banging sound in the background, and it's her playing with these toys that we've given her to try to distract her. And, like, Alex is talking about, like, white supremacy, and it's, like, really serious things. And there's Mazzy, like, standing on his lap and, like, just, like, trying to leave. And V was really awesome. You're trying to, like, distract her the whole time. Like, look over here.
I was there for that episode, but I don't think any listeners knew, because my job that day was literally to entertain Mazzy.
And you did such a good job. Yeah, yeah. And so that's why I chose this clip, just because it's like, this is why I love doing the live thing, because you, like, never know what's going to happen.
I think that this whole period, and especially with, like, online activism, you know, it's like this thing that's happening, like, people are like, you have a responsibility now to say something. If you're not saying something, you're complicit. And yeah. I think that it's me trying not to fall into complicity, but it's more than complicity, it's fear. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that I just don't want to be afraid in this country, or I don't want to feel like this concept of white nationalism, this big boogeyman.
Yeah. Right?
Like, it's like, I'm just trying to deal with that. It's like, I just don't, like, I don't know what that is, you know? It's like, I don't know if it's real. I don't, I mean, it seems real, but I'm just trying to respond to that by just saying, like, hey, I'm Chinese, like, I'm here, I'm Asian, I'm not, like, I'm not a majority in that sense. But then also tackling the idea of what it means to be a model minority, and also like, understand the privilege that I have, because I feel like my life has been pretty privileged, to be completely honest, to be able to do my own artwork and make a living off of it and live in Portland and do all these things. I'm not trying to deny that I don't have that privilege.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to figure out, I'm just trying to tackle, there's just so much processing that I've been trying to do. There's a lot behind it.
I didn't hear the Mazzy part.
There's like objects falling.
There's little objects falling, but if you were to really listen very closely, because I had to listen to it, you hear, and she's like, "Go, Daddy." She says it like twice, and you really have to listen in for it. And
like, he's like chuckling.
It's the Mazzy moment.
The Mazzy. But I love that clip, though, because, you know, what he had started talking about was like, you know, I don't want my art to speak for all these things that I don't want to speak on, or like, I think oftentimes we talk about like the ways that we're oppressed as Asians, as POC, and we don't often, or we don't make a lot of space to celebrate the ways in which mm-hmm. we thrive, or the ways in which we flourish.
Yeah.
And I really love how he put it. I think this is a good segue into my clip. So I chose a clip. It's actually from the episode in which I first appeared on. It's a mental health episode with featuring Jason Chu as a guest host. And my clip is just talking about self-care. And yeah, throw it on.
So Jason, what do you do for self-care as someone who's constantly on the road and having to, you know, express your and share your inner self as an artist? What do you do for self-care?
Yeah, man, that's a great question. I buy clothes. I mean, you know, it's I've been learning because as you mentioned, like, so many of us were not taught self-care. So it's been very ad hoc. You know, I've been realizing just reverse engineering it, realizing, okay, you know, if I spend an afternoon doing this, that makes me feel, I feel like there's no template, right? There's no formula.
Mm-hmm.
It's more just observing and doing those science experiments, you know, like, oh, when I sleep more than 8 hours, I don't hate people, you know?
Yeah. Know thyself.
Yeah, exactly. But I do buy clothes on the internet.
There's no shame in that. It's okay. It's actually something that Kanan and I love to talk about. It's like, oh, I was feeling sad. Did you did you go buy pants to take away that sadness? And we agree that buying pants actually does help sometimes when you're feeling sad. But it looks like we got the...
Yeah, so I chose that clip because I feel like that has been my biggest theme this year, is like everyone talking about self-care and like how to, you know, try to avoid traumatizing yourself from like all of the current events happening. And yeah, I really love what Jason said about like there's no template. Mm-hmm. Like there's no like guideline, like first you wake up and then you eat breakfast and take a bath and then get a massage. It's just like, you know, do what works for you. And what I found this year in terms of self-care that really works for me is like having boundaries and having knowing your limits, knowing when to say no, just not being afraid to let people down, because if you can't take care of yourself, if you can't be like the best person you are, then like you can't do much for other people.
Yeah, so much like in the last year, especially as people have really been feeling the need for self-care, because I feel like, I don't know, the election brought like a breaking point for me where mm-hmm. I could really get by in life without doing a lot of self-care. Mm-hmm. And then I felt like kind of pushed me to a point of like stress where I was like, wow, I got to do something to block out the voices. Boundaries was a big one, because before then, you know, it's just like, okay, whatever, you can tune people out. But then things became harsh and argumentative, and online especially, and in person. And yeah, so it became more about what I enjoyed was watching people go from being like, I'm going to go to the spa and like doing these, you know, like what people think of as like self-care sometimes, where it's about like relaxing mm-hmm. versus like really taking care of your actual self, your emotional right. self, your trauma and triggered self. It's like, no, going to the spa is not going to do it.
Right.
But telling you to like defriending you on Facebook, that's actually a boundary. That's like fine. And like, yeah, I've been finding those boundaries too, but still trying to make them.
Yeah.
I know this is kind of a weird segue, but I'm just full of weird segues. I'm a huge fan of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic.
Oh my gosh.
There we go. Netflix just released the second half of season 7 on Netflix. And there's an episode in there about how Twilight Sparkle has to learn about setting boundaries and self-care. And I thought, oh, this is such a great lesson for children. Because
and adults.
and adults, too. Because the episode is so right that you're spending so much time trying to make other people happy, not making yourself happy, then there's a point where Twilight Sparkle starts yelling at people. And you're just going to become like this toxic, angry, frustrated creature if you just don't take some time to relax or do something that you love. I always take 10 minutes out of my day to look at Chihuahua pictures or videos.
And apparently to watch My Little Pony.
Are you sure it's only 10 minutes?
No. Yeah.
It's like when you're on a plane, you know, and they tell you to put your oxygen mask on first before you put it on anyone else's. It's like that.
Hey, one good thing about the Jason Chu in that clip, I love how he talked about how he goes shopping, right? Because he hasn't been taught, like, we generally in our society don't really get taught, like, how to take care of ourselves. So we're just taught, like, instant gratification. And just like, I go clothes shopping. It's like, mm-hmm. No shame in that. But yeah, we definitely need to have more discussions about, like, what is long-term self-care? So I wouldn't mind if we had another episode that was like mental health, but we just talked about self-care. That would be really great.
That would be great.
Yeah, because I feel like we can never not have that conversation.
And community care, too. Because a lot of self-care is taking care of each other.
That was a look back at Pacific Underground in 2016. And this is KBOO Portland, where it's 12 o'clock noon. And it's Friday, and you know what that means. It's time for the one and only, the inimitable headline news, or news headlines, at noon, followed, of course, by Moving On with your host, Don Jacobson. bringing you the very best in seasonal music on planet Earth, because that's